It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
I'm Stuart Varney.
I'm Harris Faulkner.
I'm Brian Kilmeade, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Thursday, February 3rd, 2022. I'm Lisa Brady. All the lockdowns, shutdowns, closures, were they worth it? New research suggests it didn't do much to save lives.
When we start parsing together the other causes of non-COVID death, I believe it is very clear that we will have caused more harm than good.
I'm Dave Anthony. The Winter Olympics are underway in Beijing, but American athletes are being warned, be careful using a phone there, as China is working harder than ever
to gather up intelligence, economic information, intellectual property, research and development, academic information. You can't really overstate their efforts.
And I'm Tammy Bruce. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
Not only is the world still doing battle against COVID-19, we're still fighting each other over how to fight it. The early demonstrations against lockdowns have evolved into a lot of litigation, especially over mandates, the mask, vaccine, and online learning debates, re-energized by the Omicron surge.
I wish we were in person. I feel like I learn better that way.
Now, a new study says lockdowns are ill-founded, including school and business closures and travel bans, and that they have little or no effect on the COVID mortality rate, a reduction of 0.2% on average. Arizona Attorney General Mark Brnovich, who's been part of multiple lawsuits over mandates, tells Fox's Harris Faulkner he feels a little bit vindicated.
And I think what these studies show is what some of us knew, is that ultimately there's economic and there's social costs to these lockdowns, and yet there's very little benefit.
The new study is an analysis by Johns Hopkins researchers who screened thousands of studies and ultimately included more than 20 in their meta-analysis.
Well, they looked at many factors, and one of the factors was that you may be spreading the virus in a more contagious setting if you're not at a workplace, if you're not at school, if you're not in a playground.
Dr. Marty McCary is a professor of surgery and health policy at Johns Hopkins and Fox News medical contributor. He was not part of the analysis team.
And so when you are in an indoor area with other family members, that is sort of the perfect place to be able to spread things. The ventilation in most homes in America is not like the upper 1%, and the ventilation is poor. So they looked at the effects specifically of school closures, stay-at-home orders, business closures, and overall. And what they found is overall, the risk of mortality was 0.2%, 0.2%. And of course, we know many people died from excess mortality, that is other causes not related to COVID as a result of the lockdowns. And that's what we've got to factor. We've never really done a comparison of those two factors causing public health harm.
What about any impact on slowing the spread? So if the basic finding is this didn't help to really prevent deaths overall, what about slowing the spread at all? Did we have just as many cases even with lockdowns?
So the new analysis from Johns Hopkins really compiled many other studies. They looked at over 1,000 studies and then identified 24 that they felt had rigorous methodology. So some of those studies looked at transmission and others did not. But the general thought is that even with people not showing up in the workplace, there continued to be transmission in the community. And that is that we've had this assumption that if you are not at work, that you can't get it. But of course, you can get it from other other sources at and in the household or in the apartment building. Or, you know, people cannot stay confined in an international space station by themselves forever. So even when we have lockdowns, there's a lot of leakage. People have to get food. People have to, care for a family member who may be vulnerable and unable to take care of themselves. So there continued to be transmission just in a different setting. And this is particularly interesting when it comes to schools, because a classroom is generally going to have much better airflow and be around people who are more inefficient transmitters of the infection than, say, a household, which is the alternative to being in school.
Mm-hmm. There did seem to be a different result that was found when it comes to closing bars. I think it was like over a 10% impact on reducing mortality. I'm probably not saying that right, compared to a fraction of a percent for the overall picture of the study. Why is there more of an impact from closing bars? Is it because people tend to be in closer proximity when they're in a bar?
Yes, and the ventilation tends not to be as good in a bar, particularly in the European-style pubs. And remember, when you are in a location, it's a function of not only the airflow and ventilation, but how much air you're exhaling. And when you speak at higher volumes in a loud restaurant or pub, you tend to be exhaling more airborne particles. And so the ultimate sort of recipe for disaster is talking loudly for prolonged periods of time in congested spaces with poor ventilation. And I basically just described what many bars are like.
Did, I guess it's like a million-dollar question, okay, did COVID lockdowns do more harm than good based on these results?
So we don't have a head-to-head comparison, but what we do know now is that the overall reduction of mortality was 0.2%. What were the results of the lockdown on death rates? We are just starting to get that data trickle in. We learned, for example, in the United States that 30,000 more people died of substance abuse in the first year of the pandemic than died pre-pandemic. Now, the pandemic's been about 2 years. That could have been higher the second year. It could have been a total of 70 or 80,000 Americans who have died from substance abuse more than pre-pandemic. So when we start parsing together the other causes of non-COVID death, I believe it is very clear that we will have caused more harm than good. Now, it doesn't mean the strategy should not have been done. It just means it should have been targeted to the populations that were most vulnerable. And if there's one original sin with COVID in our policy, it has been that we've never really truly accepted that the risk is not equally distributed in the population. It is so heavily skewed towards vulnerable people. And in those, for those individuals, they should take extreme precautions at a time when we had no interventions, no vaccines, and of course, now the calculus is radically different.
Right, and I guess that's also speaks to the overall difference between, you know, being at risk of catching it and being at risk of having severe impacts or death from it, which is a line that wasn't always emphasized, especially in the beginning stages of it. People might hear this, though, and say, look, what were governments, not just in the U.S., but around the world, supposed to do? You're trying to get a handle on an airborne virus. You know, what does this research tell us for future pandemics or even future variants of this pandemic?
So, I think that's a very reasonable question. We've had so many pandemics in the world in just our lifetime, you can better believe there's going to be more. So it's important to ask these questions. The bigger question of should we have gone into lockdowns, in my opinion, the answer is you do what you need to do based on the available data at the moment. Now, when we were watching this thing play out in China and in Italy, and that is how I sort of came to the forefront of this conversation, is I said, look, what we're watching in Italy is about to happen in the United States. And no one believed it. And sure enough, it was true. We did not have good data. So we needed to close schools. And I think we needed to tell people to stay at home to avoid the spread. But a temporary transient measure is very different from a long-term strategy. And what we should have immediately done is pivot when we got the data out of Northern Italy, that this is significantly skewed in the way it attacks older and vulnerable people. We never really made that pivot.
Are you concerned that this research will only add fuel to, you know, a debate that's still very heated over pandemic restrictions?
Well, look, we have now one side of the ledger, and that is, what did the lockdowns do against mortality? They did very little. Now we are going to get the other side of the ledger, and that is, what is the excess non-COVID deaths? And as that data rolls in, and remember, typically it takes more time for that data because we've we're not just looking at immediate hospital deaths. Now we're studying people who had deferred cancer care and who developed opioid and fentanyl dependency, which may take years to truly take someone's life. So we're going to get more data, but already the trajectory of the non-COVID deaths is telling us that, in fact, we paid a heavy price in terms of lost lives to achieve a 0.2% reduction in mortality.
Should we still be trying to vaccinate as many people as possible? And I ask this in part because of Pfizer's new application to give its COVID shots to kids as young as 6 months old.
Well, what we have falsely constructed was this thermometer of let's achieve 100%, and until we get there, no one's safe. And that ignores the fact that the risk is not equally distributed in younger populations. The entire lexicon is flawed because what we should be talking about are the immune and non-immune members of our population and the high risk, medium, and low risk members of our population. So the most important thing is that we get those at risk immunized if they're not already immune. So that's where we should be putting all of our efforts, is people with comorbidities. That includes kids with comorbidities. The idea that we haven't vaccinated every 7-month-year-old healthy baby, and that's why we're still suffering with this pandemic, that's not an accurate portrayal of what's happening.
What about the issue of waning immunity? I mean, the booster shot campaign seems to have kind of lost steam pretty quickly. Are we in danger of giving COVID the upper hand because of that?
We are in older Americans and vulnerable, immune-compromised Americans. It appears they need a booster if nature has not already given them a booster through prior infection. And that is something, unfortunately, we're having trouble convincing people to do right now. Your older American who has not had COVID, they really should be getting a booster because the two-dose regimen should have been spread further apart. By putting those two doses 3 and 4 weeks apart with the mRNA vaccines, they functioned as one primer dose for some older people. We know older people generally don't mount strong immune responses. We see that with the flu shot every year. So now with the credibility of public health in the toilet, we're having a tough time really giving the nuanced message. And that is that boosters save lives for older people and people immunosuppressed. If they haven't had COVID, they really need the booster. And if you're younger, there's no evidence that boosters reduce hospitalizations. And if you had natural infection, there's no evidence you need a booster. Instead, what we see is this blanket boost every human being message. And people are smart enough to realize it's not that simple. And we're not getting good guidance.
One last thing for you. I'm just wondering, how concerned are you about where things stand right now in this pandemic, entering year three?
Well, I'm feeling good about the fact that Omicron is burning through the population so quickly that the end is very close. And when I say the end, it's going to be the end of this wave. We're going to have more variants in the future. But statistically, mutations tend to be downward, that is less severe. And it's hard to imagine a virus more contagious than what we have now. So I do see good news on the horizon. But on the flip side, our pandemic preparedness is still terrible. And we have a more divided country than we've ever had. Medical tribalism is going to hurt us with cancer and HIV and so many other areas where we really should be coming together and using an objective approach.
Dr. Marty McCarry, thank you as always for your time.
Thank you, Lisa.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is Tammy Bruce with your Fox News commentary coming up.
They've started going for the gold in Beijing. The first Winter Olympic events have started. But there are issues. Number one, COVID.
You put in 4 years, since the last games. And for all of that to go to waste in the last week, last couple days, it would be a tragedy.
That's American loser Chris Masder. There have been a few hundred cases in the Olympic bubble, including bobsledder Alana Myers-Taylor, who is going to be a U.S. flag bearer at tomorrow's opening ceremony, but is now stuck in isolation, hoping she can still compete. One of several athletes who had no idea they had COVID with no symptoms, then testing positive at the airport. China says it is putting health and safety first.
Well, it's the hope of the Chinese Communist Party that this will be a weeks-long advertisement for the effectiveness and competency of their regime.
Republican Senator Todd Young tells Fox,
"We need to provide context to these games. At the same time that we're cheering on our athletes, we need to underscore that this is not normal, having a gross human rights violator hosting these games."
Mike Baker agrees, taking some of the pure sport, he thinks, out of the Olympics.
It's the athletic pursuit. It's the idea, you know, to the degree that it still exists, of amateur athletics.
Baker is a former CIA covert operations officer, now CEO of the Portman Square Group.
I also get the concept of, you know, athletes shouldn't be, you know, pawns in political machinations between one country and another. Just let them do their sport. Well, I get that argument, but I think that there are a lot of dead and currently enslaved Uyghurs. I think there's all the jailed Hong Kong democracy advocates. I think there's the countless people around the world who have died from the pandemic, in part because, directly because, the Xi regime in China refused to be open, honest, and transparent at the very beginning. I would like to have seen China, you know, and when I say that, I mean the Xi regime, not get the Olympics. And since they did, I would like to have seen us boycott them, not just this bogus half-ass sort of faux diplomatic boycott that the Biden administration has proudly announced. So I think that's kind of where I stand on the whole issue.
But when you do that, then athletes don't go, and it's 1980 all over again, where they worked really hard to get ready for an Olympics that they didn't go to.
Yeah, I get that, but I do think that there's sometimes, occasionally, bigger issues.
But you mentioned you didn't want athletes to be used as political pawns. If you boycott, don't you do that?
Well, what I said was I get the argument. I get the concept. I don't say I agree with it.
Okay.
Because there are times, and this, from my perspective, I think there are occasions, and I believe this is one of them, when human rights and sort of our just the stance that we profess, or like the posture that we take in the world, you know, as the moral high ground and authority, I'd like us to see us act on that in this instance.
But the athletes are there. The competition's already started. The opening ceremony is Friday. Mm-hmm. These athletes were told that they had to download an app on their phones 2 weeks before they even went to China. So that led us to say, you know what, get a burner phone, just get a replacement, go there with a temporary phone so that you save yourself from potential exposure. That, at least, I assume, is something you think it was a good idea.
Yes. And for the past 20 years or so, we've been advising business executives and others traveling to China to leave all their electronics at home and to take, again, as you mentioned, a burner or a temporary phone, a temporary laptop that's clean, doesn't contain any of their important data or you know, past materials. And so that's not a new piece of advice. The difference being now that the Chinese PLA, the intel elements within it and elsewhere within the regime, are much, much better at gathering data, at pulling signals intelligence, at monitoring and tracking the movements of individual targets. And they're much more aggressive at it.
Okay.
So right. I think it's good advice.
Now, when it comes to these phones, I mean, we think about, okay, my phone as a device, it's going to be, if I don't bring it, I'm safe. But so much data on a phone is now in a cloud.
Can they access, even through a burner phone, your information on a cloud, potentially, if you're not careful?
Well, if you're not careful, you've said exactly the important point there. If all they do is just give all these, you know, athletes and supporting cast the advice that says, hey, just take a different phone, and that's it, and they're not holding security briefings. And look, the U.S. Olympic organization, they've got a very switched on security group. And I would assume, and I believe they have brought in cyber experts to discuss this matter in more detail than we've seen. You have to provide that. You have to be careful. It's almost impossible to overstate the aggressive efforts of the Chinese regime over the years to gather up intelligence, economic information, intellectual property, research and development, academic information. You can't really overstate their efforts.
Several years ago, when it was President Obama in office, he had an agreement with China where they wouldn't do economic espionage. You're laughing.
Yes, I am.
Why?
Because it's kabuki theater, because it's performative art. And that's what, you know, unfortunately, you know, so much of our political activity over here in out of Washington, D.C. is. Look, not just one administration. I don't really have a dog in the hunt. I tend to be small government in my thinking. I think the government should do just the basics. There was never any intention on Xi's part to honor those sort of agreements. And there is no evidence. In fact, there's evidence to the contrary since then, over the past few years, that if anything, they've ramped up their efforts.
Now, the other day, you might have seen this, the FBI director, Christopher Wray, he went to the Reagan Presidential Library out in California, and he talked about how China presents a broader threat to America and our innovation and our economic security than any other country in the world. And he likened them to the Soviet Union, but he said,
China is an economic power on a level the Soviets could never have dreamed of being.
And you know what made me think of... when you think of that, we have so many things made in China. I mean, in the 80s, how much did we have that was made in the Soviet Union that we relied on, right? I mean, it's really different nowadays than it was then.
Yes, it's much more of a threat, much more of a holistic threat to U.S. national interests and security than the Soviets. So the Soviet Union, you know, not to oversimplify this, but it was a matter of nuclear destruction. That's what we were really focused on. We weren't focused on the fact that the Soviets were somehow going to take over the world through innovation, theft of intellectual property, development of new technologies. That wasn't the concern, except as it applied to weapons systems.
Right.
So with China, it's a completely different ball game. They made a decision decades ago that they would get to the top of the food chain globally by essentially skipping the heavy lift, cost and time of research and development. And that's essentially what they've done. And they do it in a variety of ways. You know, now it's enabled in part by, you know, access to new technologies and cyber activity, but they still do, you know, a variety of different efforts to collect that intelligence. So, yes, this is a real concern. Now, Christopher Wray, the FBI director, also said that he was blown away by the scope and scale of Chinese spying. And I would argue that we shouldn't have an FBI director who at this stage of the game is surprised in any way,
right,
at the scope and scale of Chinese espionage. So I'm perturbed and a little confused and disturbed by that comment.
I want to ask about the current standoff between the U.S. and Russia over Ukraine and the troop buildup there and the concern of an invasion. How close do you think that President Xi in China is watching how that plays out as it pertains to Taiwan and Hong Kong?
The answer to that is he's watching it very closely with probably a certain amount of amusement and a bag of popcorn at his side. Xi is watching because he has a timeline, undoubtedly, and a playbook with various scenarios for Taiwan. And that is much like for Putin, where Putin's end game is to rebuild in some fashion the former Soviet Union.
Right, to bring the band back together, right.
Right, exactly. Xi's end game, in part, aside from getting to the top of the food chain, is Taiwan. And so he's watching this very closely.
What would happen, in your view, during these Olympics, if an athlete, a high-profile athlete, an American athlete per se, comes out and is very strong against China on human rights and makes a big protest during a medal ceremony or something like that?
Well, first of all, I would applaud that. I know some people would say, well, the Olympics is not the place to play politics. But, you know, we've seen what happens when, you know, if an athlete engages in some form of social justice, usually it's applauded. I would argue that this is global social justice to call out the Chinese regime on its horrendous human rights record. So I would love to see an athlete or athletes, you know, take some sort of stand. What do I think the Chinese regime would do? They would be very upset. You know, it's not as if they would jail the athlete. That's a bridge too far. But they may well, you know, show them to the door and ask them to politely leave.
Well, it might be something we watch in the next couple of weeks. Maybe not. We'll find out as the Olympics get underway. Mike Baker, former CIA covert operations officer, current CEO of the Portman Square Group Intel and Security Firm. Also, host on Discovery and Discovery Plus of the show Black Files Declassified. You have a new season on that coming up?
We do. Thank you, Dave, for mentioning that. I appreciate it. Discovery appreciates it. The Science Channel appreciates it. It's the second season launches, I believe, on the 9th of March. We've got some fascinating episodes. We spent the past 6 months almost traveling around the country and overseas investigating and exploring some really fascinating subjects. And so hopefully folks will be sitting in front of their Philcos or Sylvanias or whatever you switch on nowadays and tuning in.
Well, we look forward to it. And Mike, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Dave.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Download and listen to Tyrus and Timp. Every week, Fox Nation host Tyrus and Fox News contributor Kat Timp give their hot takes, explore weird headlines, and share amusing stories. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com. Rate and review the Fox News Rundown on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
It's time for your Fox News commentary. Tammy Bruce. What's on your mind?
For over 2 years now, big tech has flagrantly done the bidding of the Democrats and progressive establishment, as we've been lectured and hectored to respect and accept science. That demand is applied to anything the establishment has deemed correct. If you do not comply, you will be punished, and then punished again, and then canceled, and probably fired. And yet, here we are being told by Apple that a new emoji depicting a pregnant man is being released in the next iPhone update. We plebs seem to be getting punched in the nose every day by some big tech big brother suspending or canceling us for being science deniers or for spreading misinformation by the very same people who are now telling us that a pregnant man is real and normal. This is what I call having reached the woke apex. Something ridiculous, completely on its face, contrary to real life and or directly anti-science, getting injected into our lives and lexicon simply because it moves along the absurd, progressive, and woke narratives. The mocking on social media has been swift because everyone knows biological men can't get pregnant. Nope, the pregnant man does not exist. There are biological women who identify as men, but still have their reproductive systems intact, and voila, they are capable of getting pregnant. Recognizing that this is not transphobia, and it is also not news, it's a fact. But that doesn't get you a headline or a way to continue to try to pit Americans against each other when you'd rather they not notice you're busy destroying the economy, turning American cities into crime scene hellholes, and getting us into a war with Russia. Still, men can't get pregnant. And everyone knows it. To say otherwise is also an insult to transsexuals, who continue to be used like chess pieces by partisan political operatives as their lives are objectified and sensationalized. As a gay woman and former liberal community organizer in the 1990s, I was appalled at repeated meetings where the goal was, what could we use to get attention and raise money? It was never about making lives better. It was always about exploitation and debasement. All of our civil rights movements have been based in the idea of being left alone so that blacks, gays, and women could choose to pursue lives that best suited them. None of our success requires the erasure of entire social concepts about who we are as people. So why are they politicizing emojis of all things? And who are they anyway? It's the Unicode Consortium, that's who. They are the deciders of the emoji. And surprise, like every other progressive establishment effort, it's a tiny group of people, in this case, 10 big tech and corporate honchos, deciding what will and will not become an emoji. This matters because it's a reminder that the left has always relied on small groups of people in powerful and influential positions, continuing to artificially influence society and culture on behalf of what they think benefits the Democrats. We all know this, and yet big tech and their leftist overlords have a very strange fixation in gaslighting us. Are they pushing the envelope to see how much we'll put up with before we've had enough? That time is now. The only answer is to completely reject this fraud of a few at the expense of everyone.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. Stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com. From the Fox News Podcasts Network, download and listen to The Untold Story with Martha McCallum. The host of The Story on Fox News Channel sits down with major newsmakers each week to get their untold story. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Kilmeade. I want you to join me weekdays at 9 a.m. East as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and, of course, what you think.
Listen live or get the podcast now at BrianKilmeadeShow.com.